Hi, welcome to this week's program. You know, due to the unusual market volatility of the last few weeks, I've decided to change things around a little bit and bring in a market expert. If you follow this show, you know this gentleman. He is the chief investment strategist of CFRA. He's a regular guest on the show because he takes an historic approach to the market, focusing on market history, valuations, momentum, and other things like that. CFRA is an independent equity research firm, which was acquired by S&P Equity Research Department in 2016. And I mention it because Sam is well known in the industry for being affiliated with S&P Equity Research. So all that said, I'd like to welcome Sam Stovall to the show. Hey, Sam, welcome to the show.
Hey, Steve, good to talk to you again.
So let's get right to it. We've had, in one way, a very unusual type of volatility. We had all of this low volatility for so long, and market experts have been talking about it. I know that I've been talking about it with clients, but everybody's been feeling that it hasn't been quite right. What kind of context can we put the low volatility in first before we get to the high volatility?
Well, you're right. 2017 had two things going for it. First off, we had more than 60 new all-time highs, which was twice the average for any year that had at least one all-time high. At the same time, we only saw 8 days in which the market was up or down by 1% or more, as compared with an average of 50 every year since World War II. What I found out was that in the years following such high number of new highs and low volatility, volatility actually got back to the average number in that second year. So we're actually seeing history repeat itself because volatility has most definitely picked up early in this new year.
What's breathtaking about it is that it seems to have picked up in like 3 seconds flat. You know, there wasn't any real warning. I think some of it has to do with the fact that there's a saying markets rise in a stair step fashion, but they go down in an elevator fashion. And perhaps the reason is that fear is a stronger force on our behavior than greed. Any comments on that?
I absolutely agree. I actually believe that adrenaline enhances memory retention. That's why we remember where we were when tragic events occurred. And that's what the financial media tries to instill in viewers every day. So when these financial shows say, the world is coming to an end tonight at midnight, tune in tomorrow to see if it really did, you know, they just want to maintain the viewership by creating some sensational commentary. And I think that is human nature to be drawn to that.
Yeah. And I think when you see the market down a lot, you get that kind of, you know, terrible feeling in your stomach, you know, like an elevator going down too fast. And you kind of wonder, you know, where is it ever going to end? Or is the elevator going to kind of crash on the floor and it's all over? I'm going to lose everything. I'm sure in your statistical analysis, if people stayed put, there really isn't any, you know, evidence that they crash and burn, you know, to zero.
Exactly. Even in the great crash of 1929, you only lost money when you sold. The market did not go to zero. In fact, the most recent bear market in which we lost almost 60% of the S&P 500's value got back to break even in only 4 years. Even somebody who retired on the day that the market peaked has 20 years to live in retirement, and therefore, you know, the first 4 years, they're just waiting to get back to break even. You know, if you don't have 4 years, then you should not be invested in equities. But still, don't make the biggest emotional mistake of turning a paper loss into a real one.
Okay. That's exactly what my experience and my studying in the market has shown. And you're seeing the same thing, and you're a statistician. So let us take a look at what just happened. Now, you know, this is going to be aired, you know, the week after next. Valentine's Day, let's put it that way. So as a Valentine's Day present to all of you, we're going to talk about how terrible the market was in the weeks following January. First of all, let's talk about January. This is what's so weird. January was a fantastic month, surprisingly.
Well, January is usually a very good barometer as to what is likely to happen for the remainder of the year. If you've ever subscribed to the Stock Trader's Almanac, you do know the old saying that as goes January, so goes the year.
Mm-hmm.
Both Yale and Jeffrey Hirsch are friends of mine, and I took that advice and took it one step further and found that it even works for sectors and sub-industries within the S&P. But it's a very good indication that if investors are willing to pile into the market in January, we have had about an 11.5% price gain in the remaining months of the year, along with a batting average of about 85% of the time the market went up in the remaining 11 months of the year after it posted a positive January.
Well, you know, calendars are, in a sense, fictitious. They're just, you know, you mark one day and then you mark another day and then you build a system. You know, the world, you know, revolving around the sun doesn't really care about it so much. So January seems a little arbitrary, especially considering that just a week later, pretty much all of January's gains were wiped out. So where does that put us?
Well, I agree with you that you could say that it's really more of a continuum than a calendar, but businesses work on the calendar year, or a lot of them do, and they enact their budgets in January. Also, pension funds tend to add money to their portfolios in the beginning of calendar years.
Right.
Usually, we wait to see February in terms of bonuses, and we start to max out 401ks early in the year. That's why the old adage of sell in May takes place, in my opinion, is because of a lack of capital inflows after a lot of money has moved into the markets into the first 4 and 5 months of the year. So, yes, I still believe that there is some effect from the calendar, and that's why seasonality is not something to be ignored.
Okay. So, how far ahead of itself, when you look at these moving averages and you're looking historic rise or fall in the market, and then you see, hey, the stock price went way above that average. How far above that moving average did the S&P get in January?
Well, it got 7% above its 50-day moving average and 14% above its 200-day moving average. And please excuse my nerdiness right now, but both of these measures were more than 1.5 standard deviations above the mean, or in other words, pretty rare occurrences and levels of excess that really had to be worked off, either in time or price change. And what we found was it had a big impact in price in a very short period of time.
Yeah, so it came right back down to the averages, would you say?
It came down to the 50-day moving average. Actually, both the Dow and the S&P broke below their 50-day moving averages, which is what I think contributed to the mass sell-off, the 1,000-point decline, mainly because it then triggered sell stops for investors who had been riding this bull market upward and kept elevating the level at which they want to get out in order to lock in profits.
Yeah.
But we're still well above our 200-day moving average.
All right. So the 200-day moving average, not to get too nerdy, but this is a more serious number because it takes into account more time. And so if the market would continue to fall, where is that 200-day moving average number?
If the market were to continue to fall, or at least go down to that 14% decline threshold, it would be around 25.35 on the S&P 500.
What does that mean for the average viewer? Where is the S&P now?
What that means is that from the January 26th high of 28.73,
okay,
it would be about a 14% decline or a mid-level correction, but certainly not the beginning of a new bear market.
Okay, good question there. So we're still within the framework of a bull market. What number, is there such a thing as a number, but where would the market have to go to signal a change in direction to a bear market?
Well, we would have to lose about 560 points in total on the S&P 500. We would have to lose 20% off of the most recent high, which was 28.73, because that is the definition, if you will, of a bear market.
Mm-hmm.
Now, here is where you could be splitting hairs by saying, well, wait a minute. So 19.5% is a correction, but 20.5% is a bear market.
Yeah.
And the answer is yes, because humans are compartmentalizers. We like to put things into categories, mainly because like a pullback is 5 to 10%,
yeah.
A correction is 10 to 20%, and a bear market is 20% plus. First off, because it's easier to categorize them. But second, the deeper you go into a decline, the greater the percent change needs to be in order to get back to break even. If you lose 5%, yeah. It only takes 5% to get back to break even.
Mm-hmm.
If you lose 50%, it takes 100% to get back to break even.
Right.
So I think that's why we break them into those three categories, so that we have a better feeling for what is the magnitude of the following recovery that is needed to get back to the starting point.
Okay, interesting stuff. But as of now, we are still well in bull market territory. My guest, Sam Stovall, Chief Investment Strategist of CFRA. Sam, thanks for taking time to talk with us today. This is Steve Pomerantz, and you're listening to The Steve Pomerantz Show. Chances are most of you have forgotten how spooked everyone was around March 2009. That's when the Dow hit a low of about 6,600. And boy, oh boy, since then, the Dow has rallied ginormously to about 23,400. That's up a whopping 16,350 points over the past 8.5 years for an average annual increase of about 16%, well above its long-term average annual return of about 6.5% to 7% over the past 130 years. So we've had quite an amazing run of late. The Dow is now close to its all-time high of about 23,600, which it hit on November 7th, just a few weeks ago, and well above its October 2007 pre-recession peak of about 14,100. We're also past the dreaded month of October that's historically been pretty traumatic for investors. And not just that, the Dow was actually up 3.6% this October, so that was welcome relief for investors as well. Moving to other indexes, the S&P 500 has essentially moved in lockstep with the Dow since 2009, but the NASDAQ, which primarily consists of tech stocks, has performed even better, with an average annual rate of return of 21% over each of the past 8.5 years. That's pretty phenomenal. Those who stayed invested through the downs may have had immense satisfaction of seeing their stock portfolios soar over the past 9 years or so, which brings me to what's on a lot of investors' minds nowadays. How much further can this rally go? And when might this party stop? Should you continue to stay invested? Should you go out and get out and wait for the dip? Should you hedge your bets or diversify into other asset classes? Now, these are really tough questions, and no one, not even myself, can give you definitive answers to them. Even so, let's try to make sense of it all. I'm going to reconstruct the factors that drove the rally, then deconstruct it to predict what might happen next. So let's start with why we've had such an amazing rally. And here's a few reasons that jump to mind. The first is that the Fed was very quick and decisive easing interest rates from about 5.25% in July of 2007 to virtually 0% by December of 2008. When that move finally sunk in about 3 months later, by March of 2009, the rally in U.S. stocks began. The potential reason for the rally is that many investors may have realized that CDs and bonds offered near zero returns and stocks were the only place to be. The second reason behind the rally was that the Fed saw the carnage and the massive risks to our economy and, despite a lot of opposition, stepped in and initiated its quantitative easing program in late November 2008. Now, it spent $3.7 trillion to buy government bonds, bank debt, mortgage-backed securities, stocks, and other financial assets in order to stimulate the economy. The idea was that buying massive amounts of financial assets would raise asset prices, keep interest rates low, reduce borrowing costs, increase money supply, and spur lending and investment that would help the economy recover. While some may disagree, I do believe the Fed's bold actions played a leading role in bringing our economy, our banks, and our corporations and consumer confidence back from the brink and renew the world's faith in our markets. In addition, think back to the end of 2009. International markets were doing a lot worse than us. Several European countries like Greece and Portugal, Ireland and Spain were in the throes of near-catastrophic debt crises that went on through the middle of 2014. Moreover, stocks of relatively healthy U.S. companies, and especially banks and financial institutions, were selling at prices that were construed as shockingly low by many, and that brought in record flows from U.S. and foreign institutional investors. There's one more factor that's been pretty key for the markets over the past year, and that was Donald Trump's election as president on November 8, 2016. He ran on a platform of offering tax cuts and less business regulation, and that stance may be viewed as favorable to business, and combining that with the hope of less government intervention and lower taxes, with the generally solid earnings from U.S. corporations, it's led to a 31% rise in the Dow as of today from the time Trump was elected president. So what now? Do you stay invested? Do you hedge your bets? Or get completely out? Let's deconstruct a little. All right, coming to the present. Interest rates are still really low. Fed funds rate is 1 to 1.25%, and it's projected to rise to only about 3% in 2020. In parallel, mortgage rates are also near all-time lows. So this accommodative interest rate environment bodes well for housing, investments, job creation, and corporate profits. On the flip side, policymakers at the Federal Reserve are confident that the U.S. economy is on a steady footing with inflation under control at about 2.2% and unemployment down to just 4.1%. So they've started unwinding their purchases of government and agency bonds this past October, starting with a reduction of $10 billion each month through December, and then ramping up the reduction by $10 billion every quarter. So my math shows that they could take away $1.65 trillion from the bond markets through the end of 2020. Now, while this is old news and should already be factored into the market, it could just become a psychological trigger that pushes traders over the edge and causes a sell-off in bonds and a spike in interest rates. That could also rattle the stock market. Now, let me put in a caveat here. This unwinding could do damage, but the Fed has clearly stated that they will put unwinding on hold if the economy worsens. I don't think the Fed will stop if it's just to prevent markets from correcting, though. So this is still a pretty real risk. As I said, the Dow's been up 31% since Trump was elected, but his healthcare reform efforts have failed, so there's a chink in his armor. And the markets are watching to see if he can deliver on tax reform by December 31st. And even that looks to be in question, with very different versions from the House and the Senate. If Trump fails to deliver on corporate tax cuts, markets could give back some of those gains from the Trump effect in late December or early January. But the clearest reason for the market correction lies in what some consider to be overheated stock valuations. For instance, just last month, Goldman Sachs reported that the S&P 500 has a forward price-to-earnings, or P.E. ratio, of 18.7, which is way above their long-term average of about 13. And that puts stock valuations in the 98th percentile, which means S&P stocks have been below current levels 98% of the time. Or put another way, they've been above these levels only 2% of the time. More tellingly, over the past four decades, stocks have been more expensive only 11% of the time. So if you buy at current valuations, there's also a pretty good chance that your future returns on this new money will be below historic returns. So lower your return expectations going forward. Now, these lower returns are still above what you're going to receive by investing in bonds. So stocks may still be preferable to you because of this low return environment. Now, getting back to my point on how much longer will this party last? These lower returns may slow down the influx of money into the market, which also may soften stock prices. Stock valuations are trippy right now, but it makes sense that they are, in my opinion, because when interest rates are this low and inflation is this tame, you would expect stock prices to be high. But any significant change in either of these two factors may spook investors enough for a rush to the exits for profit-taking and may cause shares to give up 10 to 20% or more. So, very high valuations, Fed policies, and even politics could take the punch bowl away from Wall Street and bring the party to an end. Now, I don't foresee a major crash, But a reasonable correction is certainly not off the cards, especially over the next few quarters, and that might be just another buying opportunity. So speak with your financial advisor and talk about locking in some of your gains, perhaps, or hedging your bets, or perhaps investing in something that has an inverse correlation to the market. And having said all this, though, trying to play the game of cat and mouse with the markets usually ends up in tears. So you may just consider staying put and riding it out. Are there any topics we're missing, guests we haven't thought of that you'd like on the show, questions you want answered? Contact us anytime at stevepomeranz.com. That's Steve, P-O-M-E-R-A-N-Z.com. Simply go to stevepomeranz.com and click contact to write us anytime, anywhere. Articles on the site you liked or didn't? Want to share your 2 cents? Comment on any of our guest interviews and tell us. You know, this show's purpose is to empower and protect you on all things financial. We'd love to hear your feedback so we can make sure we're getting you the information you need to live your one best financial life. Contact us at any time at stevepomeranz.com. That's Steve, P-O-M-E-R-A-N-Z.com. This is the Steve Pomeranz Show, and I'm Steve Pomeranz. My next guest is a Boston-based journalist who chronicles the glorious underbelly of American society, and he has spent a lot of time investigating the great con artists of the 20th century, and he writes about one in his book, My Adventures with Your Money, George Graham Rice and the Golden Age of the Con Artist. And the journalist is with me here today. His name is T.D. Norton. Hi, T.D. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me on today.
So I had never heard of George Graham, otherwise known as G.G., but from the way you describe it in your book, he sounds like one of the greatest characters of the 20th century.
Yeah, well, it's fairly interesting that you brought that up because I had never heard of George Graham Rice either before I had started researching the book for My Adventures with Your Money. And the genesis of how I stumbled upon George Graham Rice was I was actually working on a freelance article about con artistry, a magazine piece. And I had researched an article. I'm a serial Googler, and I had landed on a 1934 article from Time magazine. And basically, the gist of the article, when I found it a few years ago, was whatever became of George Graham Rice? He was the greatest con artist of his era. Why aren't the modern con men as charismatic as this guy is? And I had followed the shadow world of confident hustling peripherally, kind of as a hobby. And I said, wow, how come I've never heard of this guy? And it was like an onion. The more I started delving in and the more layers I uncovered about George Graham Rice, I found out what a fascinating and forgotten character that he actually was in the early part of the 20th century. He was front page news basically from 1900 up until the Great Depression. And the reason a lot of people have never heard of George Graham Rice today is, without a spoiler alert, without giving away the ending of the book, his downfall coincides with the roller coaster ride up during the Roaring Twenties, and then the massive crash in the Great Depression. And by the time George Graham Rice went from big time to small time, it was no time. However, in his day, he was the fraudster in terms of scale that we would compare to a modern Bernie Madoff, except the critical difference is George Graham Rice, which was only one of his many aliases, by the way, he operated with the flair and showmanship of P.T. Barnum, the circus promoter.
Yeah, let's get into that. Hang on a second. Let's get into that because there's a lot here. But just to whet my listeners' appetite, this person that you speak of, this George Graham Rice, he pioneered many of today's modern marketing ideas, concepts that are still in use a century later. For example, the celebrity endorsement, using sex as a selling tool, outlandish publicity stunts, telemarketing, customer profiling of all these things. And then he wrote a tell-all book after that. So on the one hand, he did all this to swindle suckers out of their money. But on the other hand, I guess modern advertising is kind of all about that in a legitimate fashion today.
Yeah, George Graham Rice was nothing short of brilliant. And I make the point in My Adventures with Your Money that he could have, had he wanted to apply his intelligence to legitimate business purposes, I think we'd be speaking about him in a totally different light today and not the nefarious shadow world that he occupies in con artistry. But you ticked off a list of some of the things that he pioneered. And to set the scene for your listeners, this goes back 100 years ago when if you were affluent enough to have a telephone installed in your house, you were thrilled to hear a jangle. You didn't care if it came from what we would know today as a telemarketer calling and trying to sell you something. George Graham Rice pioneered telemarketing. He was one of the first sales persons to instruct his staff to ask people, may I have your telephone number, when they completed the transaction in roughly 1902.
Yeah.
And later on, he was the forerunner of what we would call customer profiling and data mining today, except George was a little more blunt. He called it his sucker list, and he just cultivated a list. By the time he died and they found this list, it had over 200,000 names on it.
Oh, my.
And he first started cultivating these names when he was a racetrack horse tipster, and he kept the names as he went out west to dabble in mining stocks, and when he came back to Wall Street to open what were called bucket shops, which were low-rate, cut-rate brokerage houses that never really invested your money. Every time he had a point of contact with these people, your file in his file cabinet grew fatter and fatter, and you didn't realize some of these people were contacted numerous times over decades for many of the different schemes and scams of George Graham Rice. And it might be apocryphal, but it was rumored that he even had subheadings in his sucker list under names like elderly philanthropists and millionaire widows, and he would, in a predatory fashion, he would go after these people.
Yeah.
He wouldn't be satisfied to take you for, if he knew you had $20,000 to give up, he wasn't going to be satisfied if he got $19,000.
Gotcha.
He would go for the full banana.
My guest is T.D. Thornton. The book is My Adventures with Your Money, George Graham Rice and the Golden Age of the Con Artist. So let's learn about one of these cons. I was particularly interested in the very first one where he, I'll let you explain it, but it has to do with racing, and I want to get into one thing that I noticed that made him different, but tell us very quickly about the story, his very first biggest con.
George Graham Rice had gotten out of jail on some forgery charges, and he was basically broke, and he had $7.10 to his name. This was in March of 1901. He was standing on a street corner in New York City, and off in the distance, he spied an old racetrack chum. George was looking for, he was on the hustle looking for marks who were ripe to be suckered. He didn't necessarily want to fleece his friend, but his friend came over to him. His friend was a little bit more down in his luck than George Graham Rice was. George bought him a beer. They got to talking. One thing led to another. And his friend said, hey, I have a very legitimate hot racehorse tip that I just received by telegram from a guy in New Orleans who knows his stuff. And this amounted to insider trading in the horse racing world. George knew that this horse, or had inside information that the horse had a good chance to win at odds of 10-1, but he was smart enough to, he didn't want to make $70 off of this transaction, which is what he would have got if he bet the horse straight up, $7 to win at 10-1. He wanted untold riches. He wanted a bigger entry into the world of separating suckers from their money. So what he did with this tip was he took his last $7, he went down to what today is known as the Daily Racing Form, the Bible of American horse racing newspapers. He bought a tiny ad in the back of the paper. He ran it the next day. It said, bet your last dollar on the horse's name was Silver Coin. He will win today. I have inside information. And if you like this tip and the horse wins, I have a new horse racing business, a tout service that's in business. And if you like it, this is a freebie. But after that, it'll cost you $5 a day, which was an exorbitant sum in 1901, if you want my inside information. Now, this scam only hinged on the horse winning. If the horse didn't win and ran up the track, George's advertisement would have gone into the trash. Nobody would have made any money. Nobody would have followed him. But as luck would have it, the horse won, and he won big, paid a nice price. And the next day, when George went to the storefront walk-up that he had rented on Broadway, he was surprised to see that the line extended out the door and down Broadway. He had hundreds of suckers lining up, wanting to give him $5 the next day for his next hot horse tip, and he was off and running in the tout business.
Yeah, so TD, this is what I find fascinating. I think most of us would have taken that tip, taken our $7, and been happy with earning $70 to get us through, you know, the next couple of months back in 1901 dollars. But he had bigger visions. This guy was very smart from the very beginning. And so he started this company. It was totally bogus. He rented some closet of a space. And he got a second tip. And that tip kind of worked out, too. And he built a little bit business until what? It fell apart?
Well, it eventually fell apart because it came under federal scrutiny. Because to back up a little bit, he eventually built up the business to the point where he had so many suckers subscribing to his daily horse racing tips that he was able to give, let's say on a scale of if there were 10,000 customers a day and there was a five-horse race at Belmont Park in New York, he would divide it up, and he would give each of the 2,000 subscribers a different horse. So if you scale it up, every day he was giving out a winner. Some people were getting fraudulent horses that didn't work out, but eventually they landed on a winner, so they stuck with him. And his business was big enough that he was not content to just take in walk-in customers. He went about his business by the mail. And, you know, in 1901 and 1902, it was technically not illegal to commit fraud in the United States. However, the way the government got you was they came in the back door instead of marching boldly up the front steps. If you use the federal mail system, the Postal Service, to defraud people, they would get you for mail fraud. And that's eventually how he went to smash on his horse tail racing business.
You know, it's interesting because you mentioned this idea of having, say, 10,000 customers and five horses and giving 2,000 the name of a horse. So 2,000 out of those 10,000 think that you're very smart. And then you take those 2,000 and you divide that by five. And then, you know, 400 of those think you're a genius. And by the time you get down to it, you've got, you know, whatever, 50, 100, 200, 500 people who think that you can't lose and you can charge them more and more money. That used to be a stock broker scam, by the way. Tell half your customers to buy, half your customers to sell. Half them think that you're a genius after you've done that two or three times. And they can be very powerful. We are very limited on time, unfortunately. The book is My Adventures with Your Money, George Graham Rice and the Golden Age of the Con Artist. My guest is T.D. Thornton. His first book was Not by a Long Shot, A Season at a Hard Luck Horse Track. And again, you want to read about George Graham Rice. I know I personally love stories about these great con artists. And, you know, I had some dealings with Bernie Madoff, and I was able to save a number of clients from a Bernie Madoff. So I'm very, very much aware of the dangers of these scam artists. And so I like to read about them. Final words, TD?
I think that one thing that your listeners should keep in mind is that con artists are a cyclical phenomenon. The core methods that they will separate you from your money don't change. What does change is technology and the methods by which they go after you. So George Graham Rice, in his day, it was the newfangled telephone and suckering people by telegrams. And today we do it by the internet. The same scams, the I'm a Nigerian prince seeking some help getting money. Can I use your bank account emails that we all get and have hopefully hit the delete key on every day are no different than something that was called the Spanish prisoner scam that was in vogue in George Graham Rice's time.
Well, I guess P.T. Barnum was right. I guess there is a sucker born every minute.
And, you know, the interesting thing is when I researched that quote out for My Adventures with Your Money, the true con artistry of that is P.T. Barnum never actually said that.
Oh, he never did.
It's attributed to him, but he never actually said it.
Very good. My guest, T.D. Thornton, a Boston-based journalist. The book is My Adventures with Your Money, George Graham Rice and the Golden Age of the Con Artist. T.D., thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Hold on to your wallet.
Take care. Bye-bye. To hear more stories and more interviews, don't forget to join our conversation and also to find out more about T.D. Thornton and his book. Join the conversation at onthemoneyradio.org.
Little boxes on the hillside, little boxes made of ticky-tacky, little boxes on the hillside, little boxes all the same. There's a pink one and a green one and a blue one and a yellow one, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky and they all look just the same.
This is the Steve Pomerantz Show, and I'm Steve Pomerantz. It's time for Real Estate Roundup. This is the time every single week we get together with noted real estate agent Terry Story. Terry is a 29-year veteran with Keller Williams, located in Boca Raton, Florida. Welcome back to the show, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
So here's the thing. Can developers please both boomers and millennials? The two generations don't always agree on what they want in a home. So you have a little test for me, don't you?
I'm laughing at that because I'm a baby boomer and I have millennial children. So yeah, I can see how they don't agree or they could agree.
I think you have some millennial traits, though, I noticed in our talk off air. So I want you to list some of these characteristics that some of these groups are looking for and let our listeners decide what category they think they belong in. Go ahead.
Let's start off with traditional designs, such as fireplaces, crown molding, space for hobbies and leisure activities, home offices, close proximity to parks, and exclusivity, sophistication, traditional markers, quality that include doormen, valet parking, private lounges, limo services, driving ranges, fitness centers.
Okay, all right. So what about the other group?
Now, the other group, they lead with lifestyle more centered around activity. They like diversity and inclusiveness. They prefer sleek designs that give them greater affordability to access major transportation. Indoor rock climbing.
That's it. You I think we know now what the two different groups are. So when I read this before, I saw fireplaces, molding, space for hobbies and leisure activities. And I was like, yeah, I like that. For me, the valet is a little too much and elegant private lounges and all of that. That kind of went a little bit beyond me. But when you got to the rock climbing, I realized...
Well, that's where I pick up, Steve.
Okay.
I like the indoor rock climbing, the driving ranges, the inspired happy hours.
That's what you particularly like that. I know that. Share car services. You don't need that.
No.
Okay. And workstation in common areas, like you're sitting in Starbucks or something like that.
Right.
Not so much.
No.
All right. So the question then is, how can developers serve both communities and what are they doing? You know, what kind of communities are they building in order to serve them? That is the big question. And I guess we're going to have to leave that for another time. So let's go to another topic, which is it legal for a neighbor to point a camera at my front door?
Wow. Yes. And it also just depends. Unless they're misusing the video being recorded, it's not illegal for them to have a camera at their front door for security purposes. You know, they can't help it if you're across the hall and their camera is capturing your door.
Yeah.
So it's all about what the intent is of the use of that camera. Are they really trying to spy on you? Is it, you know, a peeping Tom camera looking through doors, into bathrooms, that sort of thing?
I guess if you have a camera, let's say at your front door or over your garage, and it's looking down at your driveway and it happens to capture the front door of a person across the street, that's not going to be an issue.
That's right.
Yeah. But if it's the camera that's pointing into one of your bathrooms or something like that, that's an issue.
And it's a hidden camera.
Yeah. Gotcha. All right. So property owners have the right to place cameras in and around their homes for security reasons, but it should not be used to record neighbors or anyone where they have a reasonable expectation of privacy, like their house, changing room, or any place, maybe their backyard or something.
Yeah.
You can't do that. All right. Well, that's good. All right, so we have a few minutes left. I want to talk about what it takes if you're thinking about becoming a landlord. You know, there's a lot of people out there who have accumulated some money and they've got a lot of money in the stock market. And they're thinking, you know, I would like to diversify my holdings. I think I would like to own some income producing real estate. So, Terry, what are some of the positives and the negatives in that?
Sure. Well, first of all, positives, if you're going to start this, is you have to have a strategy. And the positive part to it is you're really looking for cash flow.
So price isn't that important because it's price relative to the amount that you can get for rent.
That's right. It's all about the yield. You know, how much you're going to get, how much is your return?
Right.
So you shouldn't really pay attention to the price. And there's so many variables, Steve. You know, are you paying cash for the property? Are you getting a mortgage for the property? All of that needs to be factored in. And a lot of people don't even realize, you know, how to calculate rate of return.
Yeah.
You have to factor in all your expenses, your property taxes, your improvements that need to be done.
You have to have a pot aside for replacing appliances, what we call a depreciation fund, because, you know, as time goes on, the roof eventually will need replacing, and that's going to be one really large outlay. So theoretically, you should be saving for that a little bit every year and put that aside.
That's right. And anticipate vacancies. You know,
when
the tenant leaves, it may take a month, 6 weeks, 2 months to get it re-rented. So
exactly. That
needs to be factored in.
So many people come into my office and they have real estate of this nature and it's just has not been successful for them. And they tell me that they're breaking even. That's kind of it. Now, look, if real estate had proved itself to be a long-term growth investment, you know, you may say, well, if you break even, that's fine. But real estate really isn't, especially residential real estate. It grows at the rate of inflation, net, net, net. So, you know, to keep pace with inflation and to break even on the cash flow, that dog won't hunt.
Yeah. And what's really important, it is a long-term investment. It's not a short-term gain.
Yeah.
If you're going to take out a mortgage, do a 15-year mortgage. So at the end of 15 years, Now you have a cash cow.
Yeah, so now you've lowered your internal expenses, and therefore you have excess cash flow, and that can take you into retirement with some benefit, right?
Right, so you don't want to start this at 90. You need to start it when you're younger and you can afford the investment. A 15-year mortgage, you got to put 20% down as a minimum.
Yeah.
I would tell you to take a 15-year mortgage out.
That's good advice. Good advice from Terry Story. As always, we are in our real estate segment, and Terry can be found at terrystory.com. Thanks, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
StevePomerantz.com now features each week's show in shareable individual segments. Busy at work and want to come back to the show later? No problem. Every segment has a full summary of what was discussed, along with a transcription of the interview. You can read or listen to one of my commentaries. Hey, is there something I mentioned on air you want to find on our site? Well, you can search for it. So check it out and let us know what you think. We'd love to hear your thoughts on what you liked or what you didn't. You can request topics you want us to talk about and ask us questions. We'll get back to you, promise. And you can like us on Facebook, where you'll find out about upcoming events and subscribe to our podcast. It's all there at stevepomerantz.com. That's Steve, P-O-M-E-R-A-N-Z.com. This is Steve Pomerantz, and you're listening to The Steve Pomerantz Show. So there is a new type investment available to all, and it's of a type which we in the investment business call alternative assets. These are investments that are different from stocks and bonds that most of us are used to dealing in. The added feature of what we're going to talk about is that the return on this investment comes from the royalties musicians receive from their artistic endeavors. So if you love music or are an artist yourself, listen up. This stuff is important to know, and I think you'll enjoy hearing about it. Just a caveat before we get started and before I introduce my guest, with any investment that we discuss, understand that I'm presenting the material to you without recommendation. I don't have an opinion on the merits of the investment we're about to discuss. So use your better judgment, do your own homework before committing any amount of money. With that said, let me introduce PJ Mikolas, who leads the investor relations effort at Royalty Exchange. Welcome to the show, PJ.
Thanks so much, Steve. Pleasure to be here.
What is Royalty Exchange?
It's an online marketplace for buying and selling royalties. Our mission is basically to make quality intellectual property in the media-based arena investable. So we've, of course, focused on music royalties to start, but we've certainly had transactions on the exchange in publishing, video, a number of different arenas, and it can certainly be applied. The model that we have can be applied to television, movies. It's just a matter of, I guess, getting into those arenas as well.
So intellectual property per se.
Yes.
Okay. IP, intellectual property. So when you talk about royalties, so I think we all kind of know that if you were, with the Eagles or something like that, that you'd get money every time the song was played. Maybe if you were a writer, you'd get another sort of kind of money if you were a producer and so on and so forth. And that money that they would receive, those are what are called royalties. Am I correct?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Royalties are basically how the money flows in the music industry. So artists don't really, and rights holders, they don't really get salaries associated with the music that they produce. It's more based on the consumption, whether it be through sales, streaming, digital downloads, licensing. And royalties are basically a cut off the top. So if you're an investor, it brings, or a rights holder, for example, it brings them to the top of the value chain. So where they get a payment based on whether it be every use or a percentage of every use. So it's really interesting on the investing side.
Yeah, I saw an interview you did with CNBC, and they played, some music prior to the interview, and the person who was interviewed mentioned, well, they were asked, are you going to get paid on us playing this song at the beginning of the show? And the guy goes, yeah, right, so play it again at the end, please,
Yeah, that's exactly right. I think, whether it be from sales or streaming, even use in restaurants, right. Bars, concert venues, rights holders are paid on all of those types of plays in some way.
Yeah, I guess if you think about walking through a supermarket and hearing that music, that it's there to create an ambiance, you're not actually directly listening to it, but all that music, it pays royalties to the rights holder. Now, what is the definition of a rights holder?
Sure. So the ecosystem of rights holders is huge. So when you look at a given song or a given catalog of songs, there's not just one rights holder. It's not just the artist and or the writer. There's quite a few other rights holders that are associated. It could be the recording studio got some royalties in exchange for their services. It could be the manager of the band. It could be backup singers, other guests on the song or the recording. There's a number of different entities that are going to control and hold the rights for a given recording or a given composition. And that's something that, you know, that's one of the major things that we're focused on educating people about, is that it's not just, you know, for the example of one of our Royalty Flow is a company that we're IPOing that's going to acquire and hold a premium multi-million dollar royalty assets, the first asset of which is that of Eminem, the rapper.
Right. Congratulations on that, by the way.
A lot of people just assume that we bought those royalties from Eminem, whereas we actually bought them from the production team that discovered and developed him in his early years and worked with him on his early recordings.
I see. Wow. Interesting. There was an article about a woman who had written songs, was a writer, and she was getting about $2,000 a year from the royalties, not very much. And through the auction or the exchange, you know, they cut her a check for $20,000, which was basically 10 years of kind of this flow of rights right up front. A very interesting thing. Let's talk about the music business and all this streaming and really the destruction of the cash flow model of the music business for so many years. Remember, we had CDs, we had records, we had tapes, and now with streaming, that all went away. And really, I think artists were getting the short end of the stick. Explain how that, if it has, explain how that has changed now.
Yeah, of course. So I think you're referencing and a lot of different institutional investment firms and banks like Goldman Sachs have come out with research reports talking about kind of where the music industry has come from, mm-hmm. where it is today and where it's going. And we're certainly on the same page as a lot of those. So basically, in the years started 1999 till about 2014, there was a pretty extreme bear market in the music industry. It started, of course, with Napster and piracy, also disaggregation, the ability to buy songs for $1 on, say, like Apple iTunes versus having to buy a whole album.
Yeah.
That 15-year period saw the music industry revenues decrease by about 40%. Now we've hit this inflection point in 2014 to 2015 where the growth of streaming and the growth of digital downloads has not just overcome the losses that you've seen there, but it's actually really led to a tremendous rebound in the industry to now where you're seeing double-digit growth year over year based on the fact that just more and more people are streaming based on the ease of accessing the catalogs and the songs that they want to access. So,
yeah,
you know, you've seen people, you know, whether it be with Spotify or other entities, they're paying, you know, $10 to $15 per month for membership and just access to those entire catalogs
right.
of songs.
Right.
And one interesting stat that, you know, that I in my conversations with investors that always seems to kind of stand out for them is that of all global smartphones in the world today, only 3% have streaming subscriptions associated with them. Mm. So there's certainly been some growth there, but there's still plenty of room left for growth. And I think investing in music royalties at this time gives an investor access in the early stages of a bull market and direct access to the growth in the music industry, because you see a lot of these royalty streams growing in revenue at this time.
Okay, so let's take the point of view of the investor now. What is the least amount someone can invest in one of these?
Sure. So at Royalty Exchange, we actually have two avenues for investing in royalties right now. So you could do so through direct ownership of a royalty. And the way that we provide access to that is through our exchange. It's an auction platform. And there's, of course, bidding associated with it. The highest bidder wins. And that's, of course, a one-to-one transaction. We've had, you know, just yesterday, we had a transaction. It was Busta Rhymes and Mariah Carey's song, I Know What You Want. It went for just about an 8x multiple. The price of that was about $36,500 was the winning bid. So that can be restrictive for an investor because they have to, of course, win the auction to get access to a direct music royalty. There's also Royalty Flow, which is actually in its IPO fundraise period right now. And that's what I referenced before with the M&M asset being the first asset, the anchor asset. What we're doing is we're IPOing a company called Royalty Flow that's going to acquire and hold premium royalty assets. Mm. What's interesting about that is that investors can size and time their entry and exit. So they can decide how much they want to invest at a given time. And then, of course, they have liquidity on the back end because this will, within a couple months, we intend to list publicly on the NASDAQ capital market. So it will be a publicly traded stock that will be the first of its kind granting direct access to premium music royalty assets.
So there's two ways to buy this pending IPO, and that is you can contact Royalty Exchange and invest pre-IPO, am I understanding this? Or when it does go IPO and becomes public, of course, you know, you can sell, or as a buyer, now it's publicly traded, you can kind of determine what price you want to pay based on the projected revenue stream and then kind of figure out your own rate of return and invest. Did I get that right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. The minimum to invest pre-IPO is $2,250 at $7.50 a share. So that would get an investor 300 shares.
Mm-hmm.
And we've seen a ton of interest there. We've actually just formed an agreement with an investment bank based in New York that's going to lead the rest of the fundraise through March. That investment bank is called Maxim Group. And you can certainly reach out to us for more information on investing pre-IPO, but then of course investors can wait for after the IPO when Royalty Flow is actually trading and invest any dollar amount that they'd like.
Got it. Very interesting. The website address is?
Investors can find more information on royaltyexchange.com. There's a link at the top of the page that says IPO that they can click on and access everything from there.
My guest is PJ Mikolas. He is with Royalty Exchange, and we're talking about this new way of investing. It's kind of alternative investments. It has its own risks and possible rewards. Again, as I said in the top of the show, make sure that you do your homework well and do not invest a dime until you are absolutely sure you understand what the risks are and you've become very familiar with what they're doing here. All right. So does a larger investor get any benefits over a small investor in this IPO?
At this time, everybody has the same type of access and entry point. It's common shares that are available. And of course, I think a large investor probably has a pretty diverse pool of investments that they're allocating towards. So this, of course, can provide a diversification benefit in terms of the income produced, but also the fact that, you know, you don't really see these assets performing with much correlation to stocks, bonds, or commodities. You know, our business model is based on proving and giving education around the fact that royalties are an asset class and they can be considered an alternative investment, but they're arguably actually one of the purest alternative investments available because, as you know, alternative investments by definition have low correlation to traditional indices.
Yeah. So let's talk about the nature of a royalty income stream. So, you know, when you buy a bond, you get a stated rate of interest, and then at some point in the future, at maturity, you get your money back. But a royalty stream really isn't that. If you put in $10,000 and you're going to get $1,000, let's say a year as an example, it's not as if sometime in the future you're going to get your $10,000 back like a bond. So now you have to kind of calculate what your rate of return is because, in a sense, you know, the first 10 years could be, in a sense, a return of your capital. And then you have to kind of figure out, well, how long do you think these royalties are going to last? Kind of like an oil well, you know, you invest in an oil well and it produces oil. And it's a lot of that initial money coming out of the ground is really your return of principal. And when that's finally done, then if the oil well continues to produce or the royalties continue to come, you know, that's when your real return starts. And then when you're all said and done 20 years in the future in this example or something, you calculate it all and you figure out what your rate of return was. So my question is, you know, when you're investing in a particular artist, How long can we really expect these income streams to continue? How do you figure that stuff out?
Sure. I'm glad you asked that question. They're actually paid. Royalties are paid for the life of the last surviving artist that created a song plus 70 years.
Wow.
So if you find an asset or a royalty that has a consistent stream of earnings coming from it, we, of course, you know, provide all the financials that we can on any asset that goes onto our exchange and that, you know, that we're putting into royalty flow, of course. If you can find an asset that has, you know, a good amount of sustainability and a long track record, that of course is extremely attractive for investors because, you know, especially with the situation that we're at in the music industry right now, where music royalty revenue streams are actually growing,
mm-hmm.
you know, there's obviously a good likelihood that those returns can continue and potentially grow over time. So it's different, you know, royalties are different artist to artist, catalog to catalog,
yeah.
song to song. But if you can see a consistent history of track record, that can give you hopefully some good indication of what the future may look like. And like I said, this is a very interesting time because you are seeing a lot of these revenue streams growing as more and more people are starting to stream and,
right.
and download songs digitally. And
I agree.
There's a lot more transparency there as well. There's a lot more data. We, you know, we can look at, you know, the amount of downloads or streams or plays
mm-hmm.
down to the single play level. And that provides us better windows with the value of an asset and the predictability of an asset's returns going forward.
Yeah.
So it's a really interesting time and the data is really only getting better.
Wow. A very interesting new topic, maybe a new opportunity. My guest, PJ Mikolas from Royalty Exchange. And don't forget to listen to this full show, get a summary of everything that we've discussed here today. Go to our website, which is stevepomerantz.com. And while you're there, don't forget to sign up for our weekly update. We'll send you an email with every single segment separated out with a summary, with the transcript, so you can hear us, read us, and pick and choose us, or you can listen to the whole show. And of course, there's a place for you to contact us because we love your letters. So I want to thank PJ Mikolas from the Royalty Exchange for joining us today. Thank you, PJ.
Thank you very much, Steve.
I'd like to take a moment to thank all the people involved in the making of this show. Senior producer Erica Stamolo, engineer Brian Zykowitz, senior editor Carol Melzone, and John Sova, who handles our digital platform. And of course, finally, contributor Terry Story. Any interviewee's appearance on the Steve Pomerantz Show does not represent any endorsement or confer any opinion whatsoever, either positive or negative, by the Steve Pomerantz Show or any media by which the Steve Pomerantz Show is distributed. Thank you so much for joining us.
Investing involves risk, and listeners should carefully consider their own investment objectives and never rely on any single chart, graph, or marketing piece to make decisions. The radio show is intended for informational purposes only, is not a recommendation to buy or sell any securities, and should not be considered tax, legal, investment advice. Please contact your tax, legal, financial professional with questions about your specific needs and circumstances. The information in the show is obtained from sources believed to be reliable. However, their accuracy and completeness cannot be guaranteed. All data are driven from publicly available information and has not been independently verified by United Capital. Neither United Capital nor any of its affiliates makes any representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this recording, and any liability as a result of this recording is expressly disclaimed. This recording should not be relied upon to evaluate any potential transaction. United Capital is not giving tax, legal, investment advice by means of this recording, and this recording does not establish a client relationship with United Capital.